A lot of this show has focused on human beings causing a lot of problems. We've discussed a couple of things in the past, like the Emu War. We had a whole episode dedicated to elephants. But in general, humans have been the primary focus of this show. But today, we're going to look at several problems that animals have caused throughout the course of history. It's going to be a fun, just a weird episode. Because, you know what? It's our weird world.
Our weird world.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I am your host, John Henson, and a big episode today. Six stories. I'm really just burning through them today. I've got plenty, trust me. But yeah, looking at all kinds of problems that were caused by animals, just a lot of fun, strange stories. We're going to look at the horse manure crisis, the whale cure, the great catnip caper, the Barbary feathers, the parachuting beavers, and the story of Travis the chimpanzee. So we got a lot to cover today, so let's go ahead and jump right in. We start at the end of the 19th century in 1894 when human civilization was really reaching a breaking point. Cities were becoming really crowded. People needed reliable transportation. And for centuries, people were relying on horses to accomplish that goal. But there was one big problem with that. Horses, as living creatures, needed to perform the same bodily functions that all living creatures must do. Now, in London at that time, over 50,000 horses were needed on a daily basis to carry people to and from their destinations. That actually did not even take into account the other horse-drawn carriages that were delivering goods to the various neighborhoods around London. All of these horses, of course, needed to be fed, and as we all know, what goes in must come out. So in 1894, there are so many horses, and the streets are just littered with manure. A single horse, just for reference, a single horse produces about 25 pounds of manure every day, along with 32 ounces of urine. Multiply that number by more than 50,000 horses. And you can kind of see the problem that people were dealing with. I mean, like, quick math here is 1.25 million pounds of turds in London every day. Every day. It's a big mess. To make things worse, a horse typically only worked for an average of 3 years before it usually ended up just collapsing and dying in the street. Like, that's how hard these horses were working. And a lot of them just ended up collapsing and dying in the street. And because horses are very large and difficult to remove, London authorities were basically forced to leave the carcasses in the street to decompose so they could more easily chop them up and remove them later on. So now, not only do you have just mounds of horse manure in the street, but more than likely, like every few blocks or so, there's just a dead horse rotting in the street. All right. And in the summer months, like, I know London's not exactly Miami, but it can still get pretty warm in the summer. So I'm sure there's just a lovely smell going on there. The Times in London eventually ran an article highlighting this situation, and they claimed that in 50 years, London would be buried under 9 feet of manure, which, I mean, is probably pretty accurate, but as people tend to do when presented with such an apocalyptic scenario based on what is generally just a mildly alarming trend, everybody really freaked out, all right? Authorities from the world's largest cities all over the world, which is what it would be, a world's largest city. I don't know why I said it twice. But they all gathered to discuss the issue. I mean, this was like a G8 summit for horse crap. New York City in and of itself had over 100,000 horses. So they had even more horses than London. And they were also kind of drowning in this manure situation. But no one could really figure out a solution to this. Like, horses, they're like the most reliable transportation, you guys. Like, we can't all take trains all over the place. Like, train can get us long distances, but we need a horse to go over a few blocks, I guess. Humanity, I mean, seemingly doomed at this point. And like, not being able to just walk across the city was just not an option. Like, people, I mean, I guess they couldn't all use bicycles, or I don't know. I don't know what the deal was, but people really needed to avoid doing any sort of physical labor to, you know, travel. And so they really needed to figure out a replacement. Luckily, by 1912, Henry Ford's automobile, electric rail cars, and buses were filling the streets, replacing the methane gas emanating from the horse manure with other greenhouse gases to rip holes into the atmosphere and contribute to the continued global warming that everyone is still really concerned about but has no clue of how it actually works. Yeah. Which, I'm not going to get on the global warming soapbox. I don't, like, who knows. But, the horse-drawn carriages eventually dwindled and became nothing more than like annoying little tourist traps for when you visit the city, and the problem kind of got resolved. So people freaked out, but then they found a solution. So, you know, look, I don't know if you can directly attribute it, but, you know, cars and buses were invented because there was too much crap in the streets. So it's a fun way of looking at it. Next, we will go to Australia, still in the late 19th century here. And in 1896, word was kind of starting to spread at just how weird Australia was as a continent and a country, and just all of the crazy problems that they were having over there. One such problem that many Australians encountered was severe joint pain, which may have come from constantly running for their lives at the sights of crocodiles, extremely poisonous snakes, giant spiders, all that kind of stuff. But they also had another problem. Large numbers of whales were washing up dead on the beaches there. And because the whales were so big, it was difficult for authorities to easily dispose of the carcasses. And somehow, I don't know how you make this leap, but doctors in Australia came up with the idea that the rotting whale carcass could magically cure rheumatism and arthritis and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know what kind of science they had to back this up, but for a brief period, Australians were running. Well, probably not running, but they were getting to the beaches in droves to cozy up inside of a dead whale, which, I mean, is got to be for sure where George Lucas came up with the scene in The Empire Strikes Back where Han Solo stuffs Luke Skywalker inside a dead Tauntaun. Probably, right? But, I mean, even if that's not true, that's an accurate metaphor of what was going on here. Patients were advised by whalemen who were not doctors, but were actually just whalers with zero medical experience or any idea of how science actually worked. Patients were instructed by these whalemen to sit inside the carcass for up to 30 hours in order to be symptom-free for 12 months. Probably because inhaling all of the ammonia and other noxious fumes that come with dead, rotting animals was enough to kind of just take your mind off of any problem you had at the time. But eventually, this whole idea of a whale cure was found to be stupid and not accurate at all, and it died out. So let's go to 1909 in New York City, where Hermann Gottlieb wanted to get rich quick. Why am I talking like that? That's weird. I think it's because my voice is a little bit off. I'm recording this in the morning, and so I still have like kind of like a dark or a deep morning voice, and it's almost, it feels like a radio voice at this point. And so now, I want to talk like this. And I want to read the stories in front of my screen like this. But I'm not going to do that. That was pretty good though, right? Why is that also, like, why is that the voice for radio announcements? Why is that monster truck voice guy always that intense? You know, just like, Sunday, it's the monster truck rally down at the Veterans War Memorial Coliseum. Look for Gravedigger and the other monster trucks that we don't know the name of. As always, kids get in free. Yeah, it's just like, why do we talk like that? It's so stupid. Anyway, back to Hermann Gottlieb. As a quick-thinking businessman, he knew that the wealthiest of people in New York City loved to spoil their cats because back then, people were sensible and did not waste their time and money on trying to keep dogs. They preferred cats, as they should. I'm still bitter about last week's episode. He also knew that there was a wooded area in Manhattan, because Manhattan was not yet overgrown or overtaken by skyscrapers and stuff like that. But he knew that there was a place where wild catnip grew in abundance. And so after going out there and filling his baskets full of catnip, Hermann started going door to door along Fifth Avenue, famous for where all the rich people are, and was selling catnip to everyone who had a pet cat. But Hermann, he forgot that cats were not just indoor creatures. And so as he walked down Fifth Avenue, stray cats began emerging from the alleyways, completely intrigued by the intoxicating scent that was coming from Herman's baskets. And at first, like, Hermann tried to get rid of the strays. Maybe he probably dropped a little catnip down as a distraction, but they kept coming. And within a few blocks, Hermann was surrounded by as many as 40 cats who were just purring and pawing at his baskets full of catnip. And at that point, Hermann began to panic. I don't know why. I mean, that sounds like a dream. 40 cats surrounding me, purring, wanting my attention and love? That sounds great. Some of you are disgusted right now. And honestly, you're the problem, right? Cats are great, right? That's just the truth. But Hermann, I don't know, maybe Hermann had a severe cat allergy and this was going to wreck him if he kept staying around all these cats. When he arrived at the intersection of Fifth Avenue and 114th Street, Hermann saw Police Sergeant John Higgins and ran up to him and, like, tried to see if Higgins could do anything to disperse this cat mob that had formed behind him. Instead, Higgins arrested Hermann for causing a crowd to gather, which is apparently illegal at the time in New York City because America, freedom, except when you break one of 50,000 laws that are on the books. But we're not going to get on that soapbox anytime soon. As Hermann sat inside the police station at 104th Street, several cats began gathering outside the police station while Hermann was being questioned. Lieutenant Lasky, who was tasked with processing this arrest, was like, bro, we can't hold this guy. Like, he literally didn't do anything wrong. And that was because of the law for which Hermann was arrested, or that he was allegedly violated, stated that it was unlawful for someone to do something that caused a crowd of people to gather. And it was very specific on that. And so because cats are not people, Hermann technically had not done anything wrong. And there was no reason for him to be arrested. But as Lasky and Higgins kind of argued over the semantics of that law, Pete, one of the station's cats, because even police like cats, you guys, he proceeded to fight every single cat that, like, tried to wander inside to get the catnip. And by the time all of the cats had been removed, the officers eventually came to decide to not charge Hermann at all, but he placed him in a paddy wagon and was driven home. Along the way, every cat that had followed Hermann to the station did their best to keep up with the speeding wagon, but none of them were able to keep up. But by the time Hermann got home, he sprinted up the steps to his house. And as he turned to check his surroundings before going in, he noticed one old black cat looking up at him. And he grabbed a handful of catnip out of his basket, threw it at the cat, and decided just ran inside. So, fun little story there about cats and catnip. It's always fun watching cats play with catnip. It's so silly. Our next story here is about the Barbary feathers. For whatever reason, all right, people in the late 19th and early 20th centuries really, really loved ostrich feathers. Outside of slave trading and blood diamonds, the feathers were like one of the biggest industries in Africa. It's dark, but it's true. Although South Africa dominated this competitive ostrich feather market, the highest value feathers were these mysterious Barbary feathers, which came from an unknown location in Africa. Though, if you kind of know where the Barbary Coast is, you kind of know where the feathers were coming from. And I do believe the Barbary Coast is like, kind of like where like Liberia, Ivory Coast is, I think. Hang on. Well, now I don't want to tell you wrong. I could be wrong on that, actually. It's not there. It's around Morocco. So if you knew that, you were very frustrated with me right there. But yeah, North Africa, the Barbary Coast up near Morocco, stuff like that. When word got out that Ernest Thornton, an ostrich spy, because that was apparently a thing that you could actually be back then, when word got out that he had defected to the United States, the ostrich feather smuggling community really freaked out, because it was understood that Ernest knew where the Barbary feathers could be found. And to make sure that the feathers could continue to be farmed, South African officials recruited Ernest's brother, Russell, in 1911 to lead an expedition into the French colonies of North Africa. I guess, you know, kind of assuming that, you know, Ernest would have told his brother where the feathers were, but who knows. From there, Russell needed to smuggle back a flock of ostriches, just not the feathers, just a whole flock of ostriches, before Ernest and the Americans could steal them away, despite there being no evidence that Ernest was even going to do that. You know, Ernest goes to America probably because he's tired of going on these African expeditions, and the people in South Africa are like, oh man, he's gone to America. America's got all of the resources. They're going to come back and they're just going to take all of the ostriches from the Barbary Coast. So, we're going to get his brother and he's going to go up, because surely he knows where they are too. And he's just going to bring back the ostriches to us before the Americans can get to them. Genius plan. The mission was completely top secret, with South Africa's government warning Russell that they would outright deny any involvement in this before if they were caught. The group traveled several hundred miles. Russell's group traveled several hundred miles to the Barbary region in search of the famed ostriches, but they didn't find anything. And not really willing to return to South Africa empty-handed, Russell then rerouted the expedition through Nigeria and onto Timbuktu, where French authorities prohibited them from taking any of the ostriches in their colonies. But Russell, like, he's not going to give up this secret mission that no one knows, allegedly, that... I don't know where that came from. That was a weird taste. I'm sorry. leaving it in. He and his team ended up kidnapping 150 regular ostriches, I guess, and led French authorities on a chase through Africa to try to get them back. Despite catching malaria in Niger, Russell and his team, with help from local Muslim leaders, managed to board a ship in Lagos and arrived back in South Africa a few days later with 140 of the original 150 ostriches. And upon arrival, this is what makes this story hilarious to me. Upon arrival, the expedition was informed that the ostrich feather market had completely collapsed and that the feathers were completely worthless. So that's fun. That's a fun story. This is a weird one. All right. We've got two stories left here. We're up to World War II now. And shortly after the war, many people began migrating west, and the town of McCall, Idaho, became especially popular for whatever reason. But because the town was situated on a lake, the influx of people became a problem for the multitudes of beavers that had inhabited the area for centuries. The beavers, who were not one to just roll over and let people take their land, began destroying irrigation systems and crops from the landowners that had come out there. So the Idaho Fish and Game Department was tasked with coming up with a solution, and they figured that it would be pretty simple to just move the beavers somewhere else. Unfortunately, the Fish and Game Department didn't really feel like constantly traveling the winding mountain roads in Idaho, so they tried to brainstorm some more efficient solutions. And after what was likely some significant, thoughtful debate, authorities decided to pack several beavers into boxes, strap them onto a horse, and then slowly transport them over several days to a conservation officer's house. That officer then loaded the beavers into his truck and transported them to another set of horses where they would be taken to their new home. And that solution did not work at all. For whatever reason, the beavers just kept coming back. They kind of knew where they were going. So they probably also didn't really take them that far. So they had to figure out another solution. And since the war had just ended, there was actually a surplus of war materials left over. And authorities decided that their next best bet was to get several airplanes and leftover parachutes and drop the beavers somewhere new. After several tests with an old ornery beaver named Geronimo, authorities decided they had their best plan. And so by the fall of 1948, 76 beavers were thrown out of the side of an airplane and dropped into their new habitat. A year later, those beavers had built new dams, made new families, and had a whole thriving ecosystem. So I guess it worked. Just chucking beavers out of an airplane and hoping for the best. And it worked. So, you know, probably a little inhumane, but it worked. So who cares? Our last story here is about Travis the chimpanzee, who was born on October 21st, 1995, at the Missouri Chimpanzee Sanctuary in Festus, Missouri, which is roughly 30 miles south of St. Louis. 3 days later, he was adopted by Sandra and Jerome Harold, who named Travis after Sandra's favorite country singer, Travis Tritt. So this is a good family, all right? You're going to name a monkey after Travis Tritt. Sure. The couple then took Travis back to their home in Stamford, Connecticut, where they treated him as if he was their actual child. And soon Travis became a local hit. The Heralds owned a towing company, and they often used Travis in their advertising. They took him out on the road with them. And he even started like greeting police officers whenever they got together to tow a car away. Travis even eventually learned how to open doors using keys. He learned how to dress himself. He learned how to take care of plants and the Herald's horses. He even ate dinner at the table with the family. He memorized the ice cream truck schedule and knew when it would come by. Even more, this is crazy. Like, he knew how to log onto a computer. He knew how to watch baseball on television. He knew how to brush his teeth. And he knew how to drive a car. Under super close supervision. Like, he wasn't just out running errands by himself. Like, the Heralds would just let him drive the car. That's insane that he could be that good at all that stuff. It's crazy. In October 2003, though, Travis jumped out of the Herald's car after a pedestrian threw something at the car and hit Travis, which is not okay. And like any normal person would do, like, Travis unbuckled his seatbelt and chased after the man, but, you know, he wasn't able to run him down. Obviously, though, that's kind of a no-no, a unhinged chimpanzee running through the streets trying to attack somebody. And police caught up to Travis several hours later and then proceeded to have like this weird cartoon style chase where police would coax Travis into the car, only to have him jump out the other side and then chase the officers around the same car. So it's like, who's chasing who at that point? Like, police catch him, Travis is put in the car, all of a sudden, Travis, he's out, and now he's chasing after the police officers. Just the whole Benny Hinn song playing in the background. The incident, of course, led Connecticut lawmakers to sign a bill prohibiting people from keeping primates over 50 pounds as pets. Just to give you a comparison, Travis at this point weighed 200 pounds. Chimpanzees are big, big old boys. I did not realize that a chimpanzee could weigh that much, but Travis did. He's a big old boy. The next year, Jerome Harold unfortunately died from cancer, and the Harold's only actual human child also died in a car accident. And both events obviously understandably devastated Sandra. And she coped by treating Travis more and more like a son, going so far as to sleep and bathe with him, which I don't know who's sleeping with their kids, but like really getting into this now. Well, on February 6, 2009, Travis grabbed Sandra's car keys and just walked out of the house, which, weird. Sandra and her friend, 55-year-old Charlene Nash, ran outside to try to bring Travis back in. On the way out, Nash took a Tickle Me Elmo doll, which was one of Travis's favorite toys, just to try to get his attention and get him back inside. When Travis saw the doll, he snapped, and I get it. Tickle Me Elmo, really annoying. And he attacked Charlene Nash. Sandra panicked, grabbed a shovel, and then just bonked Travis over the head with it. And that didn't really seem to work, as Travis was still very violently attacking this woman. And so Sandra then grabbed a butcher knife and stabbed him. But guess what? When you are in a complete fit of rage, being stabbed is not going to do anything but make you angrier. And so Travis, he's now just really giving it to this woman. And so Sandra runs back inside to call for help. And when police arrived, Travis walked up to the cruiser and tried to open the passenger door, because he's probably just like, yep, I get it. I should go away now. But when the door was locked, he got mad again and just smashed the side view mirror on the cop car. Travis then walked over to the driver's side door, which was unlocked. And as soon as he opened it, Officer Frank Shafari shot him several times. Travis then ran into the house, where he then collapsed and died next to his cage. With Travis dead, that problem solved, the attention immediately turned back to Nash, who had just been gruesomely mauled. She was rushed to the hospital and underwent 7 hours of surgery just to keep her alive. In the end, this is crazy, she lost both hands, her nose, her eyes, her lips, and most of the rest of her face. Although doctors successfully reattached her jaw, obviously you lose your eyes. She was left blind. Her injuries were so disturbing that the hospital ended up providing counseling to the staff who helped her. Like, just crazy traumatic. Nash was immediately recommended for an experimental face transplant because, I mean, look, guys, it's not like it was going to get any worse. She was transferred to the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, and on November 11th, she got the transplant and revealed what was left of her original face on the Oprah Winfrey Show. So you can go find the clips. It is, it's not great. All right. It is. I do not recommend it. It's like, I feel bad for the woman, but, no, not at all. 2 years later, Nash underwent a successful face and hand transplant. You can see the updated pictures, and I'm here to tell you, not that much better. It's still horrifying. It's horrifying in a different way. Still horrifying though. Unfortunately, she ended up developing pneumonia shortly after the procedure, and doctors were forced to remove the prosthetic hands, I guess. Or maybe, no, this is when she ended up losing her hands. I know I said she lost her hands after the mauling, but this is when she did it. Sandra Harold ended up dying on May 24th, 2010 from an aortic aneurysm. And this happened during the middle of a $50 million lawsuit. Yeah, I bet. That was filed by Nash's family. Nash ultimately ended up receiving $4 million as part of the settlement. And that ends today's stories. So that was adorable and also horrifying at the same time. lots of different stories there, but all kinds of good little fun historical facts that you can probably just, if we're being honest, you'll forget this by the end of the week, but just fun stories, just showing that animals can cause problems just like people can. So let's recap and see what we learned today.
What did we learn?
Number one, cars were invented to combat the growing manure crisis in the world's largest cities. Probably not, but I mean, it's close, I guess. Number two, people legitimately thought that you could stuff yourself inside of a dead whale carcass for 30 hours and be cured of your arthritis. Why? Because we're pretty stupid. Why is my voice squeaking like that? Wow, that was weird. I'm so sorry for that. I don't know. That's weird. I don't know what's going on with my voice there. Crazy. Number three, don't keep a 200-pound chimpanzee as a pet, please. They are very violent creatures, and they will wreck your face if they get mad. And they will get mad at some point. Why? Because they're animals, and they don't have control over their rational thoughts. Probably because they don't really have rational thoughts, I don't think. I don't know. Chimpanzees might. Do they? I don't know. This is leading to a lot more questions than I anticipated. But that's it. That's it. We're done here. Next week on Our Weird World, just another crazy episode. We got five stories of some of the most insane soldiers throughout history. We're going to look at the stories of Gerard bin al-Azwar, Jacob Miller, Adrian Carton Dewart, Chris Ryan, and Yogendra Singh Yadav. All of these stories, insane. All right, like think back to the July 4th episode where we discussed a couple of those Vietnam heroes. These guys on a similar level. Just the things they did in war. Crazy. All right. Cannot oversell this enough. It's going to be a crazy episode. So thank you all for listening. Keep telling all your friends and keep it weird.